this process, by the way, works.
Yeah.
I think it's like natural law. Uh-huh. It's always worked. If you break down a business, it has to require those things.
Yeah.
It has to require those five domains of growth.
You're listening to Business Lunch with Roland Frazier. This is your seat at the table. Welcome to the show. Today, Roland Frazier got to sit down and dig into conversation with Paul Lemberg, a renowned business coach. Paul has consulted with Fortune 100 companies like Cisco, Adobe, IBM, Goldman Sachs, and JP Morgan Chase. But simply put, Paul helps entrepreneurs make more money.
Hey everybody, this is Roland Frazier with Business Lunch, and I'm here today with Paul Lemberg. Paul, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hey Roland, I'm doing really well. Thank you.
When I first encountered you was years and years ago, you had a product called Formula 5.
Ah, yes.
So it was kind of a recipe for business in five steps, right? What were the five steps? Do you remember?
Of course I do, because I'm about to bring out a new kind of version of it.
Oh, fantastic. It was a great product. Like, I remember.
Within about 6 weeks, it's coming out.
Nice.
Yeah, the five steps never change. Mm-hmm. So the five steps are improvements to lead gen, improvements to conversion, improvements to margin, mm-hmm. Which has more to do with pricing than just about anything else.
Okay.
So it's a lot of stuff about pricing and creating value inside of a price. I'm actually working on a book that's a recycled title called How to Sell at Higher Prices Than Your Competitors.
Okay, nice.
So pricing/margins, the next one is monetizing the customer. You know, what do you do? And you know this as well as I do. Most people sell one product to one group one time. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. And they manage to become comfortable, wealthy, even fabulously wealthy.
Sure.
But they're missing, like the 10x you'd get on the customer if you bothered to monetize the customer.
Right.
So monetization. And the last one's a little different, which is it's about systemization.
Okay.
And systemization, prioritization, use of time, things like that. Because when you talk to people about the first four, most entrepreneurs say, I don't have time for that.
You know,
I already have my hands full.
Yeah, right.
They ask me, I go to the room and I say, okay, who here has free time?
Right.
Right. And nobody puts their hands up and everybody laughs.
Right.
Because it's like, and it's that nervous laughter. Right. It's like, free time. Like, what is he, an idiot? You know, we paid to see this guy.
Right.
There's always someone in the room mm-hmm. who's really got their stuff together. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, yeah, I got plenty of free time. And yeah, I have a staff of 20 people and I don't even have to tell them what they do. They read my mind.
Right.
Yeah. If you could set that up.
Actually, when I go in, it messes them up. that's the ideal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the last part is really to give people ways to get more leverage on themselves so that they can execute on the first four.
And is that the order you think things should go in, the five?
No, I have struggled with this the entire time I have thought about this sequence.
Okay.
Because there's actually no right way to do it.
Right.
None.
Right.
You know, you say, if you have a startup, mm-hmm. there's a right way to do it.
Okay.
But if you have a going concern, there isn't.
What if you have a startup? What's the right way to do it then?
If you have a startup, well, you better get a conversion process. Oh, but you can't do that without leads. Mm-hmm. So which one should I do? So I think the problem with the startup is you just have to go into it knowing that you're going to waste resources.
Okay.
Right. You have to go into it knowing that you have to generate leads, mm-hmm. which is the first step.
Okay.
But you have to know that you're going to screw it up.
Is there a system that you advocate for implementing to start generating the leads?
Yes.
Okay. So would it be better to start with the system for generating the leads? And so it's basically system leads, then system conversion system, et cetera. Or is it, let's just throw a bunch of stuff up against the wall first, find where there's traction or product market fit, and then build the system around lead gen.
Yeah, the latter.
Okay.
So I think it's Reid Hoffman, mm-hmm. the guy who created LinkedIn, says that in the beginning, you have to do things that don't scale.
Right.
Right. You have to do things that are not systemized.
Right.
And it's just simply because scaling and systemizing and getting it right is all overhead. Mm-hmm. So, well, wait a minute. We need money now.
Right.
Right. Right. If we need money now, then we're just going to get leads any way we can. So, no, you don't want a system. Right.
Right. Right.
You want to just throw something against the wall. For me, one of the biggest deciding factors, how do you do this, mm-hmm. is can you test cheaply? Mm-hmm. Right. So when I walked in here, you were talking about direct mail.
Yeah.
And one of the hard parts about direct mail is, can I test this offer cheaply.
Right.
I was once testing something for a client, and we were looking to do radio. And we were looking to do radio in Calgary. Mm-hmm. Turns out you can't test radio in Calgary.
Mm-hmm. At least, or at certain times of the year.
Well, if the demand for radio time is saturated.
Right.
So in other words, that there is no excess, then there are no deals.
Yeah.
And if there's no deals, testing radio is not cheap.
It's expensive, yeah.
Right? Now, if you have excess, you know, if you can get remainders, mm-hmm. then, oh, you actually can test radio cheaply.
Right.
So there's markets you can test it cheaply. Just not in Calgary.
Right.
And never at any time during the year. It just can't be done.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's a really interesting lesson. If you can't break the test up into small enough pieces and you can't test it cheaply, then that's not what we're going to do first.
Right.
Right. Because we don't have the money to be wrong.
Right.
Right. You can only be wrong in little pieces.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So I think A, in the beginning, no system. Mm-hmm. B, you have to start with leads because you have to. Mm-hmm. And then the proper thing to do with those leads is figure out your closing process. Mm-hmm. Once you figure out your closing process, now you can up the volume of leads. Oh, now you have some money. Now we can figure out, oh, now we can actually raise the prices on our product and start making some money on it.
Right.
And then you figure out monetization last.
Right.
And when you get all that stuff working, that's when I believe you put the systems in.
So you started a business not long ago. I think the last time we met, was it a year or two ago? Last time we sat down?
It was about 2 years ago.
Yeah. And I think you were in an e-com business that you were just kind of getting going at the time?
I was running that for a friend of mine.
Okay. Is that still happening?
Yeah, it's still going. It's still great.
How did you approach that and apply your Formula 5? And is the new one Formula 5?
So the new one hasn't been named yet. My code name for
Formula
it is...
Formula 5X.
Well, depending on the day, it's either little F5, because I'm not really thinking too hard about it. Uh-huh. I just think of it as little F5. Or it's F5 Hyperdrive.
Okay. All right.
So I haven't decided.
All right.
I have to decide very soon because I'm about to start recording
it. Right. it's helpful, you know.
Yeah.
So in the business, we talked about startup. You kind of are just trying to figure out what works. But for the people who are listening or watching that have going concerns that are profitable, how would you, if you were coming in to help them with their business, or if you took over and were then the owner of the business, what would you do first?
The very first thing I would do is, and I almost always do this. I just did this with somebody else's business. Mm-hmm. It's the first thing I'm going to do is see if I can raise prices.
Okay.
Which could be changing prices because sometimes you lower them. Mm-hmm. It's funny. We were talking about direct mail. Mm-hmm. And direct mail is a volume business.
Right.
So often when you're thinking about volume businesses, you think about lowering the price. Mm-hmm. Because all we want to do is get more volume out there. We want to get more first-time buyers out there. And then we'll just monetize the hell out of it.
Right.
So you almost don't even care. I was just working with somebody that has a business where the front-end price is totally elastic. Mm-hmm. In other words, if I make the price lower, I will get more volume. And there's no two ways about
right.
it. And what's cool about the business is they can make money on the front end when the prices are higher. Mm-hmm. But the real money is actually made in the upsell.
Right.
And that's just how this business is. And when I really figured out the margins, I figured out how much we could lose on the front end, and it didn't matter.
Right.
Like, up to a point, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. We couldn't lose enough on the front end to kill off the back end.
Right.
So I was like, let's just get the prices. And we came up with some secret ways to sell it so that the competitors could never see what we were charging. Mm-hmm. And sales, well, so it's year over year. Forget sales. Bankable money has doubled. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited about that.
Nice.
You know, when the actual bank account is doubled and the volumes are continuing to increase, I think we've had a good day.
That's a pretty good thing. Yeah.
So really, I'm going to always look at pricing to begin with.
How do you approach that? As far as, do you first look at, can I raise prices, or do you say, can I lower? Or do you look across the full funnel at LTV and, you know, the different levels, or how do you approach that?
So the piece of this we're looking at is the front end sale. Mm-hmm. In a lot of businesses, it doesn't matter what you charge on the front end because, yes, you can make money on the front end, but it's de minimis relative to what we're going to make on the back end.
Sure.
So I don't care.
Right.
At that point, if it's that kind of business, I'm looking at lowering front end.
Okay.
On the other hand, if it's a marketing intensive business where we have to be able to put more money into the front end than the company's currently doing, mm-hmm. a lot of times they can't do it because there's not enough margin in the front end deal.
Right.
So it takes too long to recapture that money.
Right.
Right. That liquidation time matters a lot.
Yeah.
People talk about LTV and what those initials are, lifetime total value or mm-hmm. lifetime customer value. Mm-hmm. Lifetime's a really stupid measure how long does that lifetime take? Mm-hmm. So if lifetime is 6 months and then the customer's out, lifetime's fine. I can count to 6 months. Mm-hmm. But if I have a customer, how long do you say you've been here? 29 years? Mm-hmm. So you've been a customer of this building for 29 years. Right. What's the lifetime value when you walked in the door?
Right.
Who the hell knew?
Right.
There's no way to forecast 29 years. In fact, there's like almost no way to forecast 5 years.
Yeah.
And maybe even 2 years.
Right.
So
5 you can do in a real estate because you got a 5-year lease usually,
sure.
Right?
But there are things.
How many renewals, how many options, all that kind of stuff.
And even car sales.
Yeah.
You could say, okay, the average buyer buys a new car. I don't even know. I'm thinking 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. I'm a leaser, so it's 3 years. Mm-hmm. But it might be probably 5. Mm-hmm. And the average home buyer buys a home every 7 years. Mm-hmm. The smart real estate agent is looking at those people for 6 years.
Yeah.
But to say lifetime, who knows? Mm-hmm. Also, if I'm worried about lifetime value in order to recapture my investment to get that customer, mm-hmm. that's not interesting.
Right.
Right. But I might want to look a year out.
Right.
So I think of the L as long term.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Long term, not lifetime. And the distinction is really important.
It is.
Long term is how long you can afford to have the money out. Right. So think about your business like that. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, I don't have that much money. I have 6 months worth of money. Mm-hmm. Then my long-term perspective is 6 months.
Right.
Now, what's the value of my customer in 6 months? This is a smart thing to look at, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of how I advise people.
It's, okay.
All right. So let's look at that. So once we look at pricing, it's either going to go down to capture more front end, or it's going to go up so that my recapture time to get my money is maybe it's now, mm-hmm. or maybe it's 6 months from now, but it's not much more than that. Mm-hmm. But then I want to look at monetization.
Okay.
Because any business, I realize I lower my voice when I say any business because I want to suck you in and make you think, mm-hmm. could this be my business?
Right.
Right. Am I doing the most to create value for the customer? Mm-hmm. Your salespeople, people who are dealing with the customer, mm-hmm. a lot of them don't like upsells. Mm-hmm. They don't like to do upsells because somehow upsells feels to them like the image of a sleazy sales guy, right? That's what sleazy sales guys do. It's like, oh, well, you want this. Oh, well, what about this?
You bought your car. You want keys with that? You want tires with that?
What about this? So it has a bad rap.
Right.
But I heard this thing from Jay Abraham. God, it must be 15 years ago. And I immediately took it in and I've been saying it ever since. I always give Jay credit for it because it's really brilliant. Yeah. What you're doing when you're upselling, assuming that you're an ethical salesperson, an ethical business person, what you're doing is you're helping your customer get the full value of the thing they were trying to get that they're typically too cheap to buy. Most people don't get the full value of what they're looking for.
Right.
And they don't get it simply because there's a part of human beings which is trying to conserve resources.
So in value here, we're talking kind of utility.
Yeah, but it could be like joy.
Okay.
It could be sex.
Okay.
It could be anything.
Right.
So it's right. Whatever that utility factor is, which could be fun. Most people don't think of fun as utility.
Right. Right.
If I'm buying.
I'm a recovering attorney and accountant. Therefore, utility is like that's blast.
A word for you.
It's amazing.
I went to business school, but it's not my word. But say, if I go buy a new suit. Mm-hmm. Is it about utility? Mm-hmm. No, the suits I have provide that utility.
Yeah.
No, I buy a new suit because I want it to look freaking fabulous.
Sure. Yeah.
But I'm too cheap to spend $5,000 on a new suit.
Right.
Right. I got to be talked into that. Mm-hmm. That's what the sales guy does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? The sales guy helps me figure, this is in the upsell, right? Mm-hmm. The sales guy helps me figure out what it is I was really trying to achieve mm-hmm. and then get the best of that.
Right.
Whereas our survival instincts keep us from doing that.
Yeah.
Right. Our survival instincts say, dude, I know you want to look awesome. You're not spending $5,000 on a suit.
Right. Right. Right.
Like that's like, why not? Why can't I have the $5,000 suit? And now I have to talk myself into it.
Right.
Right. I have to have that argument with myself that no, it really is worth that much because I'll be so happy for the next 5 years that it's worth the money.
Right.
But that's a hard argument to have with yourself. Mm-hmm. That's where the great sales guy, the great person with the upsell comes in.
Right.
So we have to do upsells because the customer is never going to lay out $100,000 for your consulting. What is it, like $100 a day?
Mm-hmm. For me?
Yeah.
No, I don't do consulting, only ownership.
If they paid you $100 for the day, would you do it?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't.
Well, it's an interesting question.
Yeah,
it's a good way to find out what your real values are.
Yeah,
is to go to the extreme of the value you place on them and see if you still feel that way.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would look at it based on what else I had that was going on. I'd be like, a day, 100 grand for a day, I can do. Yeah, okay, cool. But but generally, I don't do it because I don't want to put even at a super high price, even at a million, I don't want to divide that by 8 hours and say, this is, because ultimately that's what you're doing.
No,
right?
Never.
I always want ownership because I want the big ride. At
right.
The
you
end.
Want the unlimited upside.
Exactly.
But still, if they were paying you $1 million for the day, mm-hmm. and I don't know, is there anybody who gets that kind of fee?
I don't know.
I have no idea. I bet Robin says he does.
Yeah, I know he has $1 million a year clients. And they
that
have
I
a certain
say,
level of access to him. And he's had that
say.
For a long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that makes sense.
If you have the leverage, that makes sense.
And to Paul Tudor Jones or somebody that's dealing in hundreds of millions or billions, it totally makes sense. It's
a million a day wouldn't be enough for him.
Yeah.
This is a man who makes billions mm-hmm. a year.
Yeah.
To make billions a year, the daily price tag is really high. You got to love those people a lot.
Right.
Right. So say we decided we want to hire not Roland, but Paul Tudor Jones.
Yeah.
And he's going to give us financial advice. He's totally worth $1 million a day.
Sure.
We can't even get on his calendar for $1 million a day.
Right.
But I don't know. Don't I want to at least read his book first, or get his newsletter or something to validate? So even there's a way to monetize the front end into the back end, and vice versa. So that to me is really where the money is made for most customers.
Okay, and what's your approach to that? Let's say I have a car dealership, and I've just recently started thinking more in terms of car dealerships because it's easier to me in the info world to say, well, we start with this lead magnet that's this little thing, and then we go up and we sell and we upsell and we get them into the thing, and then it monetizes on the back, and there's consulting, coaching, masterminds, all these things. That's a funnel that kind of the info world works
right,
with.
Right, and it works so well.
Yeah, but in a car thing, when you're talking about pricing, you can't really lower your price below a certain point if your entry point is a car because it is what it is. You have MAP, minimum advertised pricing rules. You have not a lot of margin, to work with in the first place, and a tremendous amount of competition that's out there as well. How would you approach it going into, say, an auto dealership?
So the question is always the same, mm-hmm. the way I look at it, which is what's the customer trying to accomplish mm-hmm. and how can I help them accomplish that?
Mm-hmm.
And if the customer's goals, dreams, ambitions, what have you, things they're trying to avoid are already fully satisfied, mm-hmm. then the corollary question is what else does the person who's thinking about that thing need that I can also help them
exactly.
with? Exactly. There's some pretty obvious things, and they've all been done.
Mm-hmm.
When you buy a BMW, it comes with 3 years of service.
Right.
You can't pay money for service
until
parts start to fall, and Range Rover, same way.
Right.
You buy the car, you can't spend more money on it
until
things start to fall off of
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you're selling a car that doesn't come packaged like that normally, and you can distinguish, okay, this is worth something.
Mm-hmm.
So we could upsell 3 years or 4 years, depending upon the warranty or key, I don't know, 7 years. Mm-hmm. It's like we can package the service with that. Maybe, I've never offered this. I've never seen it. Maybe you can package like a car upgrade.
Uh-huh.
I buy leases. I do leases simply because I don't like old cars.
Mm-hmm.
I want my cars to be always new.
Right.
And I don't mind making a car payment mm-hmm. for that.
And financially, it doesn't really make sense to hit to take, unless you're buying a car that appreciates in value.
I have never seen that car.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, they're Bugatti. Exotic cars do that, right? Limited edition.
Right, that makes sense.
There's markets for those. And I watch people that I know that buy them and then
actually
sell them,
buy them and they go
and
up.
Sell them for a lot more. Yes. It's like really cool.
Okay. That's interesting.
But,
I just learned something.
Yeah. But here's something I think is really cool. So, and I saw Aston Martin do this. So Aston Martin said, okay, the utility of a car or the functionality of a car is to get you from place A to place B. The Aston Martin buyer is not necessarily just wanting to get from place to
A to B. Yeah, that's not the utility they're buying.
There's a status that they want to buy. But then another layer that they layered on top of it was they did a James Bond car. They featured that in things. And so they actually had the little 007 logo on it, which is a buyer.
Cute.
Or they throw in an Hermes set of bags that goes with it for your travel. Not in the Aston Martin because it wouldn't fit, but in other cars, right? So I thought that was kind of cool ways to increase brand value and charge more.
So let's make it
margin.
Harder. Let's say we're selling a Chevrolet.
Right.
The James Bond thing's not going to fly.
Yeah, sports.
The show your friends how successful you are thing, not going to fly. Yeah. It really is about getting them around from place to place.
But it could be.
So what else could you do?
You could do sports because you have a lot of people there that are very, very big sports fans. So it would be affinity-based.
You could do that.
And then tailored, niched to particular avatars of, well, this group of people want to go tailgating. So we have the complete tailgating package, and the tailgating thing goes in the back, and it's, you know, maybe it's Weber or Coleman or some brand. Maybe it's Viking. Maybe it's something that they value, you know, that way, or tied to some influencer or personality, you know, because if you look at Kylie Jenner, who's, you know, basically built an entire
something I completely don't understand.
Nor do I, but I see how it was
astounding.
Done.
Astounding.
Right. Right. So for her market of 120 million followers or so that want to buy her cosmetics and face products and things like that, that made her a billionaire so fast, right? It might be that we brand that along that so that it's the Kylie edition and it's got, you know, right?
Affinity and star marketing, all that stuff gives you a whole avenue.
Yeah.
And it doesn't apply to a lot of businesses.
Absolutely.
It applies in a very specific thing. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking if I were a car dealer and I could package with that Chevrolet, I'm thinking low end, that if I could package a year or 3 years worth of Uber or Lyft with it, that's kind of my backup for a one car family.
Mm, have your car anywhere you want to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. If the car's down,
you have it. Would be really cool. It's like, oh, I can have my car in San Francisco and I don't have to drive it there.
Right.
Oh, so that, to me, that would be cool.
Yeah.
So one of the places you look is where's the utility that the customer's trying to get.
Right.
And I bristled when you used the word utility.
Yeah.
We'd say, all right, well, what other values is the customer? And that's probably the broadest question, which is what values is your prospect trying to satisfy when they get your product?
Right, right.
And once you start asking that question, it's easy because, we just did this from two completely different angles.
Yeah.
And Errol and I could probably do this all day long.
Yeah, it's fun.
Right? Because it is fun.
Right.
So that's it. But that's the game.
Yes.
And the game makes the customer a ton more money.
Right.
Because instead of making $10 of margin on a customer one time, or maybe it's $1,000, we figure out how to sell them more stuff, have it be more valuable in the short term, and then what else to pile on? You know, why don't the car dealers sell the car insurance? I don't know. I imagine there's some sort of regulatory issues, and I imagine they could be easily gotten around for somebody who was willing to dip their toe in that.
For sure, yeah. And then, now, they do a good job in monetization with, you go in and now it's accessories. It's, you know, you want floor mats with that. It's it's finance. We'll finance if they make their money.
There's a lot of money in the finance. I think we're looking at non-standard approaches.
Yeah, yeah. Right? No, oh yeah. I'm just saying, I'm kind of jumping now into you talked about prices and then you go to monetization.
But there's probably no margin at all for most car dealers in the car.
Yeah.
It gets beaten out of them.
Yeah.
So the margin is in the upsell.
Yeah. And in the volume rebates that then come from the manufacturers as awards for selling. Yeah, exactly. So they do a good job in that. And is that kind of what you mean by monetization? It's like, look at all of the...
Well, yeah. Where else could it be?
Right.
If I could create a deal where... And it's sort of built into the car, but there's got to be a way to do it better and more explicit, where buying this car gives me a deal on the next car automatically up front. I could lock in the price on an equivalent kind of model. Be a way to forecast that.
Yeah, yeah.
So if I could get a multiple sale out of it, that would be really cool. If I could give them such a deal on their next family car or on their kid's car or something, but build that in.
Yeah.
I don't know how many cars you've bought in your life.
A fair number.
Fair number. Have you ever once been asked by the dealer, do you need a new car for your son?
I have never.
Not once.
No.
Does your wife need a new car? Not once has anyone ever asked me questions that sound remotely like that.
Right, right.
Do you think it would work from time to time?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's like, this is true for every reason. Like, do you want to?
Also, just the follow-up. I mean, that's obviously the initial place, but
they never do follow-up.
I bought three cars at a time. They were gifts, you know, with the big bows and the whole deal.
Sure.
And never heard from the car dealer again.
I think
not
crazy,
a once. It's insane,
right? I mean, some realtors sort of know this.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But you really have to say some and sort of. whereas everybody should be thinking about, okay, how do I stay top of mind with this customer who doesn't come often, but when they come, it's a chunk of money.
Right.
Like, how hard would that be?
The car thing, to me, is absolutely a no-brainer. And it's so funny and so simple and so basic that I guess it never occurs to them. They're so focused on the deal at hand that they're not ready for it. But to me, at least after you have bought the car and you're sitting in it and you're at your most happy moment and they're showing you how all the cool stuff works and pairing your phone up and all that stuff, it should be, do you need any other cars?
Yeah.
Right? Would you like two?
Or at least, would you like to buy the backup car?
That's a free one to all the car dealers that are listening that should revolutionize the entire sales process and double their sales.
Yeah, or anybody who sells anything that is a consumer durable that has a fun factor.
Right.
Like, it's hard to say, oh, would you like a second bed? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, nobody would get excited about it.
What if you have a fight with your spouse? You're going to need that second bed. You want to be comfortable when you're effectively on the couch. Do you want to be on the couch? No, you want to be on a bed. Buy two beds.
This is where salespeople earn a bad name.
I love it. Okay, so we kind of did the two of the five. We did leads and monetization. Let's talk about conversion. How do you approach that?
So entrepreneurs, I think, probably fall into the category of entrepreneurs who know they're salespeople. They've always been salespeople, and they segued from getting paid as salespeople to getting paid as, salespeople who own the company, right?
Right.
So that crew. And then there's everybody else who says, I don't like to sell. I don't know anything about, they don't know anything about selling. Mm. They've sold their whole lives. They just don't really understand their own process.
Right.
So to those people, I say the only single thing you have to know about selling is testing. And that's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really it. I'm not, I would never say I was a copywriter.
Right.
I can write pretty good copy.
Sure.
And I can write pretty good copy that converts. Mm-hmm. I don't think of myself as a copywriter.
Right.
I think it was Bob Serling who said this, but it's like, you know, it's the old joke about marketing. And it's like, it doesn't matter what the marketing question is. The answer is, that's a good idea. Let's test it. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's like if you think of everything like that.
Yeah, exactly.
The answer to every marketing question is, wow, that's a good idea. Let's test it.
Yeah.
And if you can figure out how to convert, set up a test, then you can figure out conversion. Mm-hmm. So the simple advice for just about everyone not knowing anything about where you are is, are you testing another conversion path?
Right. And so for people that don't really understand what a conversion path is, how would you break that?
So the conversion path is anything that takes someone who has indicated any kind of interest in your product. So now you know who they are somehow. Mm-hmm. They've walked into your store. They've clipped a coupon. They've hit a click in an email. They've visited your website. They've downloaded your paper. They've done something. You know, so they have indicated interest in the thing that you have to offer. The conversion path is how you turn that person into a customer.
Right.
And the ways of doing that are too varied. I could lay out a structure, but there's no point. You've got your own.
Right.
The question is, have you tested anything about it? Mm-hmm. You know, most people say very proudly, this is how we do it. And they lay out the steps when they understand them and they show you their process and it works at some level. It just doesn't work awesomely. Mm-hmm. And you say, have you done any testing with this? What else have you done? Mm-hmm. And they look dumbly at you like, why would I do anything else? This works.
Right.
Well, I don't know. What if this one
works better?
If you have 5% conversion and you get it up to 6% conversion, how much more money are you making?
Right, right.
1%. Right. Oh, no, 20%
more. Exactly. Right? Yeah, yeah.
20% you have to do that math. More.
Right.
Can I get that extra 1%? How are you going to do it? I have no idea. Are you testing? What's your guarantee? People go guarantee? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's your risk reversal? What's your waiting? What's your free period? What's your this? What's your that? Mm-hmm. And so there's so many different points, as you know, mm-hmm. that there's so many different points in the process. You can start anywhere and test that. But if I were given advice, I said, well, how is I going to make it better?
Right.
I would tell people to look at the space where they're losing the most customers in their process. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, if you have a lead magnet and people opt in, they love your lead magnet. You know, your lead magnet page converts at 75%.
Right.
It's like, it is rocking.
Right.
Except none of those leads ever become customers. Okay, that's where you look.
Right.
Like, what did we do next? Like, how quickly did they fall off? So if you have a sales process and you can measure the change in people in your process, what you're looking for is in which step did you lose the most people by volume?
Right.
And that's the step you want to start testing most in.
Right.
Just because that's what's going to – it's probably the easiest thing to improve.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the thing that's going to give you the most leverage and the most upside faster. Mm-hmm. So without knowing anything about anyone's sales process, starting with there, where do I lose the most, and set up a test.
Nice.
And what do you test? You test anything you can think of. So I used to believe this, that any test that would give you a positive result, you know, net of cost, was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of lame. So, and I'm like, okay, for me, I really believe that if we could get a 10% lift, a 10% improvement, not 10 percentage points, but a 10% lift. So I say I have a 10% conversion. Now it's an 11. I got a 10% lift. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. I used to think that was cool. Then I heard Brian Eisenberg talk. So Brian and his brother, I can't remember his brother's name. Those two, Brian and something.
We'll call them the Eisenberg brothers.
The Eisenbergs. The Eisenbergs. Like, right? Yeah. They're like the kings of testing. They have a book which is called ABC, Always Be Testing. Great book. I recommend it.
Mm-hmm. And I think the other one, the most recent, was What Would Amazon Do? Right?
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Fantastic.
They have a different book which is about avatars called Waiting for Your Cat to
Waiting
Bark.
Waiting for Your Cat to Bark, yeah.
Which is an awesome title.
It is a great title.
awesome title. Anyway, so I heard Brian talking one day, and Brian says, we don't test anything that we don't have a reasonable belief could double sales.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, no kidding.
Mm-hmm.
That's rocking.
Mm-hmm.
So that's their sort.
Mm-hmm. And by sales, do they mean conversions or dollar sales? Do you know?
God, I could pick either one and argue for it, and I don't remember.
Yeah, I could. Okay, yeah, okay.
I cool. don't remember okay. what we were talking about.
Okay.
This was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing. Most people testing, and this is a lot of people who don't know what they're doing, people will tell you, well, you want to set up the test so that you can tell what made it better.
Right.
Right. In other words, testing one thing at a
control,
time.
Yeah.
And that control, and we're going to change the headline.
Yeah.
Control, and we're going to change the background color of the page. Control,
right.
And we're going to make the body copy bigger. Control, and we're going to make the paragraph small. I mean, who knows? Control, we're going to make the offer better. Whatever. And I listened to Brian talk, and I had two big epiphanies, which is when I was thinking small. And that 10% was a joke. And what we were looking for was, could this double? It doesn't mean it's
right.
going to double,
yeah.
but could it double?
Right.
And then the other thing was, don't worry about how many things you're testing at once.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, changing the headline is unlikely to double your response.
Right.
I've gotten 40%, 50% lifts on a headline mm-hmm. change, like on a one-word change.
Sure.
That doesn't happen often,
mm-hmm.
at least not for me.
Right.
But yeah, we're going to throw up a whole new page, and we're going to see which one does better.
Mm-hmm.
And one can easily double the performance of the other one.
Sure.
Well, what made the difference? Who cares? You got a new page.
Right? Right.
So that for me was a really big shift, was the idea that I didn't have to just test one thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was going for impact,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not going for the academic excitement of knowing, oh, two words in a headline, and you can do that too.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, you can, and maybe that's the thing.
Right.
But sometimes you have a rocking headline, and you can't come up with one that's twice as good.
Right.
At least
right.
you can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's yeah. when you hire us.
Right.
$100,000 a day.
Right. Or a million. You know? Yeah,
or a
exactly.
million.
Depending on who you.
But those two things were huge
yeah.
in terms of my understanding.
Right.
So, in terms of your conversion, you look at how you're doing it and you see where things fall off. That's the piece that you want to change. What you change is up to you. You're going for impact.
Right. Okay, so now we did leads, conversions, monetization. We know systematization's at the end. What's the missing link? What's our fourth one?
We did. I think you just pushed two of them together.
Did I? Okay.
Yeah.
Leads.
Oh, so no, we didn't talk about pricing.
Okay.
We didn't really talk about pricing
okay.
and margin.
Okay.
And That's often the first thing I do. You know, okay. Except for a startup, the first thing I'm going to look at is pricing. It's like, can we push pricing?
Okay.
I just stepped into a situation which was, it's a SaaS thing. It's selling for $97. I wanted to do some kind of promotion. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing to promote. So it's like, okay, we're raising the price. And the whole point was we're raising the price to $1.47. We're going to take it down to $97.
Right.
It's a little sleazy, but it was something.
Right.
You know, and then somebody else looked at, oh, we were talking about raising the price. Somebody else looked at it and said, well, why isn't that just your price? And I was like, yeah, it really should be.
Right. Yeah. I had that conversation yesterday.
And then
yeah.
There's the question of, well, actually, it should be $197. So yesterday I saw a checkout page and it was at $197. And I said, who did that? And the response was like, oh, I thought you said to do that. I said, I didn't say to do it. I was thinking about doing it.
But how's it doing?
But boom, there it was.
Right.
It's doing okay.
Right. Nice.
So we went from 97 to 197. Cost of the product didn't change. Mm-hmm. How much more money are you making? About 1,000,000%.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, so I don't mess up the five things, leads was one, right?
More leads.
Right.
Better conversion.
Right.
Better margin, better percentage margin,
okay,
or dollar margin on your first sale, then monetizing that customer fully. And then the last one is systemization.
Okay.
And I'm going to say systemization and prioritization.
Okay. So let's talk about that for a little bit.
So this becomes very personal, mm-hmm, because people think they're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. The real question is, are you using your time as best as you possibly can? Mm. And across the board, are things being done in such a way that you can produce a consistent result with the least amount of time to do it?
Right.
You know, if you want to scale a business and more revenue costs you more money, and the next tier of revenue costs you even more money as a percentage,
right,
and you get to the point where it's just not worth it to make more money, mm-hmm, you've built the business wrong. Mm-hmm. Right. You've done the business incorrectly, mm-hmm, because things should simply get cheaper.
Right.
And not everything gets cheaper. If you're using high-end consultants, they don't get cheaper no matter how many of them you have.
Sure. But they don't typically get more expensive.
System to grow your own.
Right.
Yeah. And then, no, they cost you a lot less.
Right, right.
So the whole idea of systemization is to be able to get consistent, predictable results, mm-hmm, so that no matter who's running the process in your business, it works out roughly the same way.
Right.
And to do it in such a way that the more you do, the less it costs. Mm-hmm. And those two things, those are requirements for scaling a business easily. Okay.
So the two things that you said, say it just one more time.
That consistent, predictable results, right, no matter who's operating the system.
Right.
And then no matter how many times the system is operated at higher levels of revenue, your expense for operating that system goes down or at least stays flat.
Right. Okay. Right?
That's scalability.
Okay. So how do you approach each of those two things? Let's go with the, we'll call it automated, not having you be essential to the business kind of thing first.
Well, so I helped a friend of mine who's an architect. Mm-hmm. He wasn't looking to scale his business. He was looking to have the business make money without him being part of every single part of it.
Sure. Which I think is something a lot of people wrestle with, right?
Yes. Yeah. There's just no way that you can take the artist out of an art. Mm-hmm. So you need to know that right away. Mm-hmm. Now, that's most people's excuse, mm-hmm, which is they say, well, I'm an architect. How can I systemize my business? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a painter. No, you can't systemize your creative aspect of your painting.
Right.
But if you look at a lot of artists in the 1980s, where I was more involved in the art world, uh-huh, and I can't tell you if this is still going on, uh-huh, but in the 80s, artists figured out that they could have other people do their paintings for them.
Yep.
And you actually could scale out of that. Mm-hmm. And this goes all the way back to Leonardo da Vinci, mm-hmm, had people who painted parts of his paintings.
Yeah.
And you look at one of my favorite paintings is not Mona Lisa, it's the Annunciation.
Okay.
And there's a few of them. Mm-hmm. And the Annunciation that hangs in Florence in the Uffizi is, I think, the most beautiful painting in the world.
Nice. Okay.
But art historians argue that he didn't paint all of the painting. And maybe he didn't. I'm not the guy who can tell you.
Right.
But they argue that parts of that painting, at least, were not painted by him. The most beautiful, that, you know, the Mary who's receiving the announcement is, he painted her. At least that's what they say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But all right, back to my architect. So how do you make this business so that the business can run without you?
Right.
Well, you break it down into its I'm not going to say it's smallest pieces, mm-hmm. but you break it down into like functional units. Mm-hmm. So say my architect buddy, his thing is he's great at getting clients and he's great at sketching off the design that completely wows people.
Right.
But once he sketches off the design, then the rooms really have to be engineered. And all the engineering stuff has to be done, like, where's the faucet going to go and how are the windows going to be hung?
And how much art is there in that?
Load-bearing beams and so on and all that stuff. Like, engineers do that. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then these things have to be presented to the boards. And you have, like, a lawyer guy who can do that.
Right.
And you can actually break the business down into a bunch of components mm-hmm. which have nothing to do with the inspiration of the architecture.
Right.
All that stuff can be done by somebody else or outsourced. Mm-hmm. And you can design each one of them so that it gets done the same way. Here's how we present to the town board.
Right.
And you lay it out and you know how it works and you know what their objections are going to be and you structure them into your pitch.
Right.
So you could systemize those things. It's just about knowing how that thing works. And then the artist, or in this case, the architect, all they have to do is the part they're great at. Mm-hmm. And then everything else is run by what is fundamentally the office manager.
And would you say then for the non-artist, it's really the things that are either your superpowers or the things that you enjoy doing the most that you should be
focused on? Maybe even you shouldn't do those.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's a personal, as I said, it gets very personal and it's a personal decision. But in any business, there are things... And people sort this. These are two completely different ways of sorting it.
Right.
It's what are your superpowers, which is to say, what are you best at? And then there's what do you love? Those are not necessarily the same.
Right.
You know, so this now becomes, how do you want to live your life? Do you want to live your life doing stuff you're great at but don't love, mm-hmm. if it was a dichotomy? And or would you rather live your life doing stuff you love and I'll make it up on the back end?
Right.
Like, who cares?
Right.
You know, I actually made that choice.
Yeah.
I do stuff I love.
Yeah.
It doesn't always
me too. It makes
make
for a happier
most,
life.
Yeah, it doesn't always make me the most money, but
I would argue that I'm ultimately it does, because I think you find ways to sabotage the things that you don't enjoy doing, even if they're making you a ton of money, ultimately.
That is there's no way I can argue with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's absolutely no way I could argue with that. So yeah, I know there's things I'm really good at. Mm-hmm. I don't totally love them, but I do them because I'm really good at them.
Right.
So
there's some fulfillment in that, right?
You just have to negotiate with yourself.
Even if you don't maybe love the thing that you're doing, you love having done it, having created the thing that you're good at, because it's fulfilling to look at it and say, wow, I'm really good at that.
It's very true.
Yeah.
It's very true. And, you know, plus you get the result if what you're doing has to do with somebody else getting some value.
Yes.
And you watch them getting the result, that can be very rewarding. It still may not be how I want to spend my hours.
Right.
But there's enough reward in it that I can hang my hat on. Yeah. It's like, okay, those are worth doing.
Yeah. You might not like shopping for the gift for your spouse, but then when you've got it and you see them light up, it's wow. Yeah. Or your kid or whoever.
Big payoff.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you shouldn't delegate some of those things, because if you can't take credit for it, maybe it wasn't that great.
Right. Right. Yeah. And also they want you to do it. I know people that automate sending texts that say, I love you.
Okay. That's psychotic.
I think it is too. I know people that have their assistants every 11 days send flowers or something. Same thing. To me, it defeats the purpose. It makes the person feel good. So that's good, but you have outsourced your caring and thoughtfulness about them. And if the thing that they're getting isn't usually necessarily the thing that makes them light up, it's the fact that you thought to get them the thing or you picked out the thing. So when you're automating that and you've got it in your CRM and your assistant and all that, I think it's, you know, personally, I would be disappointed if I discovered that the gifts that I was receiving were being done that way, because then the person wouldn't be thinking about it. But anyway, that's a different topic.
This is where modern living gets in the way of being a human being.
Right? Yeah, right? Exactly.
And I would say never. And this is like, there's not that many nevers. Mm-hmm. Never sacrifice your humanity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? And I mean, we're just flipping this around for a minute, because we started by talking. You mentioned the entrepreneurial journey.
Yes.
And the keyest of key things is never sacrifice your humanity to how you make a living.
Yeah.
And like,
the big thing out there now is human to human, and not B2B, B2C, it's human to human. And that's really where it should be, is particularly as more and more automation becomes possible with AI and machine learning and all those things, we still want to be human, right? Yeah. At least most of us, not the people that are scheduling the I love you texts, but everyone else.
Yeah, no, that's I've actually never heard of it. It would have been easy to imagine, and I think it's really appalling.
Yeah. So
don't do that.
Don't do that. So the other thing, the other half of systematization that we were talking about was that as you grow your business, as it scales, the costs should go down. How do you make that happen?
So anything that's not based on individual people and anything that's not based on rare raw materials, scarce raw materials.
Okay.
Because scarce raw material stuff goes up in value.
Sure.
Right? And just like we were talking about scarce cars, scarce everything goes up in value. And if your business uses more and more of that, your costs for it aren't going to go down. In fact, your suppliers are going to target you and your costs are going to go up.
Right. Absolutely.
Right. So, yes, and I know, yes, you can argue case in point, but it's still, as a rule, if your business is based on scarce resources, whether they're human or organic or, you know, or mineral, it's harder to scale those kinds of things.
I liked Henry Ford's approach. I was reading his autobiography. I think it's My Life and Work. Great autobiography to read. And he was talking about even with commoditized resources like steel, he was always looking at alternative components for the cars just in case there was a problem with steel. He didn't want to be shut down, so he was looking at wood as well. So he was ready with
wood cars.
Kind of cool, right?
It is cool.
Really interesting.
Pretty cool. At least as a way to think.
Yeah.
I want a wood car? I don't know.
Right, yeah. Well, not the whole thing, but just bits of it. But but so if we have commoditized...
Assuming there's a supply of raw materials.
Yeah, let's say that. If it's relatively commoditized, not something that's going to go up just because you use more of it, then how do you approach it?
So the idea that you have created a system which duplicates a process automatically reduces waste, automatically increases the value of each iteration of that thing so that your prices will go down without it. Anything that you can put a test to, your prices are going to go down. Anything that you can organize in such a way that you reduce additional labor, your prices are going to go down. So all of these things, the things that reduce errors, that reduce mistakes, I'm thinking of those as different, like reject units versus anything that you can schedule to iterate when it's supposed to, say, reduce the lag between steps and so on. All of these things bring the price down.
Yeah.
Every single one of them brings the price down.
Right.
And then if you're dealing with, say, a manufacturing process, which I actually have no experience in at all. Mm-hmm. All the things that I have done, I've never run a manufacturing operation. Mm-hmm. So I don't know anything about it. And I look at machines like, how do they work? I'm envious of people who went to engineering school or some engineering setting because they know how things work.
Right.
It's like, I couldn't build anything. I can build a cabinet. I can build a cabinet, but I couldn't build an engine.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, anything where you have a process there where you can repeat and then test it and make it better and try to hone your tolerances and all of this automatically makes things more efficient, reduces costs, allows you to do more of them without actually playing more inputs. Mm-hmm. You know, if I have a manufacturing floor and it has capacity of 50,000 units, then anything between 0 and 50,000 units, each unit costs me less because my overhead and my fixed costs have now been, my fixed costs are not going up.
Right.
One of the things I would look at when I look to scale a business, mm-hmm. or somebody's hired me to help them scale their business, is I want to look at what is the capacity of this business to deliver more of what it's got without investing more in plant.
Right.
Right. Do I, or even if it's a consulting firm, if I have a consulting firm and my average consultant's utilization is 1,000 hours, which is probably average if you think that's about 50% utilization, right? So that's good because I know I can crank this thing and make them a ton more money without spending a dime on variable costs.
Right.
But now if we are, well, maybe they're at like 1,700. And I know that the theoretical max is 1850.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Then there's not a lot we can do here.
Right.
Are you ready to hire in more people?
Right.
Because that's a big cost. Mm-hmm. That could put the business on pause when it sucks in cash. Mm-hmm. But most things can be scaled.
Yes.
Assuming, you know, we don't go where we just started the conversation from. Most things can be scaled. And simply by creating a system, the costs go down the more you do.
Right.
And the longer you can do that, the more, in other words, the more tests you have, mm-hmm. the more opportunities you have to test. You can just keep reducing the cost to a certain point. Mostly, I don't worry about cost reduction. Mm-hmm. This is like a whole different part of the conversation.
Sure, sure.
I'm worried about systemization more from the standpoint of costs not going up.
Right.
And more from the standpoint of something that's repeatable.
Right.
Even, say, hiring salespeople.
Yeah.
Right. That's a repeatable process. Making a sales call, that's a repeatable process. Mm-hmm. Almost anything in business that's not in the thing that we call art can be turned into a repeatable process.
Correct. And even with Da Vinci, sometimes art can too, right?
And Da Vinci...
certainly with the...
Da Vinci could do more than he was doing.
Certainly with the painter of light guy. I forget what his name was, but yes. He was everywhere.
He's gone, but he was a really...
He got a good run.
Businessman.
He had a good run, yeah. okay, so those are kind of the main components of the five-step thing that you've done over the time.
Optimizing any business and guaranteed growth.
So how long ago was the original Formula 5?
I'm thinking the Babylonians and the Sumerians came up with
that. That makes sense. Yeah.
Has
it been like 7-8 years?
I first came up with that idea. It's probably 12 years ago.
Okay.
But I really want to be clear about this. There's nothing that I put in that package that I invented.
Yeah, sure.
From the standpoint of this is how business has been going on since business became business, which I think is from Babylon, Iran and Iraq. Yeah.
But the organization into systems and an easily digestible, implementable, understandable things is definitely newer. What would you say are big breakthroughs that you've had since then, like over the last 3, 5, 10 years, that were insights or breakthroughs in the application or understanding or theory or whatever of it that you're like, God, wow, that's...
It's funny. I was thinking about this coming over here. Uh-huh. I said, yeah, I'm curious. Yeah, what do we talk about? We'll talk about whatever. I mean, it's always fun, but there should be value for people. And I said,
I think there's been a fair bit of value.
I'm not a specialist. Mm-hmm. I don't specialize in anything. Mm-hmm. What do I specialize in being a generalist. Mm-hmm. That's what I am. My particular background is such that I'm interested in how things work, but I don't care enough to become an expert mm-hmm. in any of them, mm-hmm. right? I'm more interested in the big picture and how things move and what we can change and move around to make this thing grow.
Right.
I had the big aha when I realized not everybody wants to grow. Mm-hmm. I had a big aha, and this is just flies in the face of a lot of what we both teach,
right?
Which is that a lot of people are doing what they want to do,
yeah.
and they're doing it the way they want to do it.
And they're happy.
They're happy.
Yeah.
Maybe they'd like to make a little more money than they're making.
Right.
Some of them would like to have things be the same and make a lot more money. That's pretty hard. Mm-hmm. To keep everything the same and have it work better.
Yeah.
It defies the natural
It does.
Law.
Right.
It does.
Right.
But I mean, it's a big aha to realize that a lot of people have ideas about what they want to do with the work part of their life mm-hmm. that does not involve growth or scaling.
Right. That's totally okay.
They sort of want to be left alone doing it the way they're doing.
Right, right.
And it used to be like I would see that as an affront to everything that I'd been working on my whole life.
You know,
I was challenged by that. And when I finally realized, it's like, no, they're just living the lives they want to live.
Right.
It's really important to realize that most everybody isn't a customer for you.
Exactly.
Right? Most everybody doesn't want the thing that you have,
right.
whether it's a new bed, a fancy Italian sports car, or like better marketing for their e-commerce store.
Right.
Like most people, they simply don't care.
Right. And that's okay.
And it's okay.
Yeah.
That drives a lot of people nuts.
It does. I had that conversation just yesterday, interestingly enough, in this very room about, is it okay that not everybody wants to be an entrepreneur?
Yeah, this is a particular one that I struggle with.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Like, how could you not? What's wrong with you?
Right, but if we didn't have those people, we wouldn't have entrepreneurs because we'd all be solo. We'd be like, where are the employees?
There'd be nobody to hire.
Where are the employees? Yeah, exactly.
Right. Who would do this job if they weren't a job kind of person?
Right, right.
Yeah, I used to, I actually had to learn this, which is people throughout the course of life would come up to me and they'd say, I'm thinking about leaving my job. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to ask any questions. I knew that the right thing to do, give them was encouragement.
Right.
And say, oh, yeah, that's it. Oh, absolutely. Go do it. And what I finally learned was, Now I say, I'm the wrong guy to ask because I'm going to tell you, go leave your job. Mm. And I'll tell you that without knowing anything about you.
Right.
And I'll be wrong 7 out of 10 times.
Right. Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
So that's also been a big aha for me.
Nice.
Is that, yeah, no, it's not even that there are people they're not cut out to be on. It's not even that. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be entrepreneurs.
Right.
And yeah, and they probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
This is the thing that I struggle with. Another thing I struggled with was the idea that you could go home and not think about work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who does such a thing?
Mm-hmm. And should you do that? You know, I don't know.
Right,
you know?
But that's, well, no, we think that the way we're living life is right. And that the people who are living life in a different way are clearly wrong.
Right.
But that's a big thing that people have jobs say.
Yeah.
To say, yeah, when I walk out of the office, I actually walk out of the office.
Yeah.
And when I go home, I'm home.
And I guess that must be cool.
And my office isn't exerting this gravitational force on me,
right?
You know, daring me to walk by it.
Right, yeah. Right. That's really
like,
funny.
I can turn out the lights. I can close the door. You mean I can turn out the lights and close the door and not walk in till tomorrow morning?
Right.
I find this shocking.
Right. That's really funny.
And that there's whole like big parts of our, what did it be, right? Almost like 7 billion people now. Mm-hmm. Most of them don't think about work at night.
Right.
They just don't.
Right.
So I had to come to those grips.
That's really
I haven't had any huge aha about the process. This process, by the way, works.
Yeah.
I think it works. I think it's like natural law.
Uh-huh.
It's always worked. If you break down a business, it couldn't. It has to require those things.
Yeah.
It has to require those 5 domains of growth.
Sure.
And so I haven't figured out too many ways to make it better, except better delivery.
Yeah.
I'm a better teacher than I was before.
Right.
You know, I have better stories.
Right.
12 years later.
Right.
But no, the thing itself is pretty freaking focused.
Well, you know, what's cool about it is that your big breakthroughs are all mindset breakthroughs, right?
Yeah. And they're all humanity.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and it's, if anything, I've become more of a human being, at least more of a human being that I like.
Uh-huh.
But the process hasn't gotten any better.
Right. That's right.
It just works.
So thank you so much for coming in today. It's been absolutely fun doing this. I don't know why we don't do it more often since we live here. Your new book is going to come out. We don't know what it's called.
No, that new book is still in the thought process
stage.
No, the new version of Formula 5, which is going to be called either Formula 5 something or something Formula 5. It's going to be one or the
other. I like
it.
Okay.
Right? I mean, we know that I got 2 out of 3 words.
That's going to be in there. Right. Okay.
I got 2 out of 3 words.
Okay.
And I've eliminated some of the orders of those words.
So okay.
And it's not going to be called 5 Formula. It's not. Yeah.
When is that going to come out?
I actually have a release date for the product.
Okay. Fantastic.
Which is the 21st of August.
Okay. So pretty soon. That's nice. And
we're ramping up some marketing campaigns for it and things in production.
Where would people go to get this?
Wow. Okay. They would go to, so the easiest thing to do, because we don't even have a URL set up for this,
mm-hmm.
but my site, which is like Paul Lemberg Central.
Okay.
Can you guess the name?
No.
PaulLemberg.com.
No, that doesn't make any sense.
It makes no sense.
PaulLemberg.pizza.
PaulLemberg.com.
Yeah.
If you go to PaulLemberg.com, there'll be a thing on the front page.
And if you're listening, just to spell PaulLemberg. Right. ERG, not URG. .com.
Not URG.
Right. And are you on the socials as well?
Yeah. And it's always Paul Lemberg.
Okay.
I mean, you can always find Paul Lemberg.
Nice.
And if you search for, and it's terrible to tell people, like, here's the address. I want to go make money and I want you to have this and I can't tell you where to go.
Uh-huh.
I apologize, but we're about 7 weeks out as we're recording this. So no, things have to get done in their natural order.
That's awesome.
And, but if you look for Formula 5 and it'll work both with letters and numbers and, or go to Paul Lemberg, you'll find this.
Fantastic. Awesome. Thank you for coming in today. Appreciate having you here.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. You've been listening to Business Lunch with Roland Fraser. If you're enjoying the show, let us know by subscribing and leaving a review. And for more information, go to businesslunchpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.